to do what do you call these things? Yell in the microphone. Yell in the iPad.
Podcast. It's the medium of the future.
Okay, sure. Yeah. All right.
Okay, and here's how you start one out. Hey, everybody. This is an omnibus bonus episode to complement our regular weekly episodes of our podcast, which is called Marvel by the Month. Sometimes I don't say that at the beginning of these things, but you probably figured it out from looking at the name of the podcast on your podcast app. We are going to cover all of the November 1969 issues on Marvel Unlimited that we didn't cover in our main episode with Will and Kevin Hines last week. Such funny guys.
Yeah.
Oh, man. What a blast. Anyway, my name is Brian Stratton.
My name is Rob Milne.
I'm Jamie Wenger.
So, boys, as usual, the November 1969 issues of Captain Savage and Sergeant Fury are not on Marvel Unlimited, probably because they have not been reprinted recently or perhaps at all ever. But that leaves us with seven issues to cover for this month. So shall we just jump into it?
Yeah,
let's do it.
All right, cool. The first issue that we'll be talking about is Iron Man number 22. The story is called From This Conflict, Death. It's written by Archie Goodwin. The art is by George Tuska and Joe Gaudioso, which is Mike Esposito under one of his many aliases. So the cover of this issue promises us Iron Man, Crimson Dynamo, Titanium Man, when these three clash, death must follow. And, you know, clearly we're being set up to believe that the death in question is going to be Eddie Marsh, the retired boxer who donned the red and gold armor to be the first Black Iron Man last issue. He filled in for Tony Stark, who didn't trust that his surgically repaired heart was going to hold out. So he handed the armor off. Didn't realize, though, that Eddie Marsh has a blood clot in his brain, which Tony Stark didn't know about when he gave him the job. So he is starting this issue out frantically flying to rescue Eddie from the Crimson Dynamo in his own Iron Man armor. You know, he's like, I can't have this guy's death on my conscience.
So yeah, what an HR nightmare.
Seriously.
It's just like the
didn't even give him a medical.
About.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Not cool.
So Tony, I keep thinking about this because this drives it home. He originally donned the chest plate to whatever magnetically keep the shrapnel from continuing to work its way into his heart. Don't try to think about it super hard, but you know, right. And then he just flew around and fought whatever, anything, just anything. And now he's got a heart that works, but he's worried that it may malfunction because it's a synthetic heart that has weird properties. But that doesn't seem really like any different at all.
No, yeah. It's
than
a
the
zero
previous circumstances.
Yeah. It's the exact same problem with like a different root cause.
Yeah. I mean, it seems like if you have a chest plate that keeps shrapnel from continuing to go into your heart, and you wiggle around by wrestling with Thor or whatever you're doing, you still are probably making it worse.
I don't want to go down like a toxic masculinity path here, but like
you don't
unlike, you know, many of the readers of the era, and probably some of the creators of the era. I do think though that I think this is like a rare misstep for Archie Goodwin to try to introduce this storyline, because for exactly the reason you just said, Rob, like if the heart was already a concern, then why, you know, I mean, I guess you can say it's like, well, the chest plate was protecting him, so he had to wear it anyway. He, you know, might as well fight the circus of crime. But, you know, at the same time, it's like it really all it does is it just like kind of tweaks the, especially when you put him up against Eddie Marsh, who is a guy who has a similar life-threatening condition, and he's eager to be Iron Man. Even though it may cost him his life, like, you know, so like, again, by kind of problematic, toxic standards, Tony Stark comes off as kind of a coward here.
Yeah. Yeah. You which know? Is kind of this. I mean, that's the great part of the Goodwin story, you know, but the fact that he's made the same problem happen and that's why Tony becomes cowardly is what where it falls apart. But the juxtaposition of the two people's situations is awesome.
Yes.
It's too bad we had to have fixed his heart. I mean, I feel like the only thing we've done is like a bunch of people wrote in letters at the time that said, wouldn't his suit be bulkier over that chest plate? And, you know, when Tony's in the office, so right. they're like, well, we got to get rid of the chest plate, you know? That's the only, like, some stupid problem was solved there.
Right.
Anyway,
yeah.
we've made it like, whatever, 5 seconds into the intro of the first issue, and I've derailed us completely. So
we're doing great.
I mean, it's just such a great opportunity for like a disability story. Like, this is a prosthesis or prosthesis, you know, the thing that helps when you need help externally.
Yeah, I think you nailed it the first time.
Like, it should be one of those. And it felt like for a second that's where they were going with it, which is like, now he needs this to do something else to help him live, but like instead he just took it off. Very weird.
Weird call. Right.
Okay, so we still have a story to get through, I think.
Right. So Tony he heads to the waterfront where Eddie Marsh as Iron Man is fighting the Crimson Dynamo, not having a ton of success. He manages to grab Eddie and get him to the hospital, where he begins the most important fight of his career, the battle for his life. And then meanwhile, as we see Eddie in the hospital, as readers, we head back to the waterfront where Eddie Marsh and the Crimson Dynamo were fighting. During their fight, a crate fell from the ship that they were fighting near, and it landed at the bottom of the river, and it bursts open to reveal the Titanium Man, who wastes no time getting into a fight with some cops. So all three of our armored characters promised on the cover have shown up. So here we go. We're getting into it.
And Titanium Man, I forgot, he looks like if Kang did a bunch of steroids and then his face was sparks.
He's really terrifying. I feel like they've given him a cosmetic makeover. I don't clearly remember what he looked like last time he showed up, when it was just kind of like him and Iron Man duking it out in Korea for propaganda purposes. But it's like he's just got these like beady glowing eyes and he just looks like a killer robot. He's great.
Yeah, and he's all green because villain green.
Yep. So back at Janice Cord's factory, she walks in on Alex Niven having an intimate moment with his Crimson Dynamo armor. and she tries to run, but he grabs her and he explains why he has resurrected the Dynamo. It turns out he was the protege of the original Crimson Dynamo, Professor Vanko, who fought Iron Man early in his career. But Iron Man managed to convince Vanko that his Soviet masters were going to have him eliminated because he was more popular than them. The thing is, Iron Man totally faked that recording. Like, it was a bogus recording. And Stan says in a little note here that Alex has given a slightly slanted retelling of events in Tales of Suspense number 46. But there's nothing slanted about this at all. Like, this is literally exactly what happens in that issue.
It made me think that I was misremembering, and that basically Tony patched in, like Iron Man patched into some actual communication and shared it. But I do remember now that he just made it up.
I went back and read the issue, and it's like, there's no elaboration here. I mean, it's like literally, Tony, he tricked him and he lied, and he tricked him into defecting, basically, which ultimately cost him his life. So Alex Niven is totally right.
There's no
to want revenge.
That editorial note is just to make us think maybe there was something more, altruistic that happened.
Just gaslighting us, man. Yeah. Like, now we know how Jack Kirby felt.
Yeah. Just scratching the surface, but yes.
After Vanko defected, back in the Soviet Union, anyone who was close to him was hunted by the secret police, including Niven. So that's why he came to the U.S., and that's why he's got it in for Iron Man. And it's not like he's not justified in wanting that. Like, his life was completely ruined, and his mentor was, basically convinced to betray his country and then killed.
Yeah, and this doesn't at all do that. Like, it doesn't describe a situation where he's the good guy or he is justified at all, right? Tone of this, but that's what is actually happening.
Retconning
himself. Yeah.
So Iron Man has arrived on the scene where the Titanium Man beat up all those cops. He gets good news about Eddie Marsh. looks like he's going to pull through. And then he follows a trail of destruction that the Titanium Man left, and it leads straight to Janice Cord's factory, where Alex has just managed to armor up as the Titanium Man bursts through the wall like a giant Soviet Kool-Aid man.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And he is just,
yeah.
and Titanium Man is just way too much for Alex to handle. So the Dynamo, he grabs Janice and he tries to flee with her in his arms, like flying out of the factory to rescue, to protect her. Iron Man, that's the moment he chooses to show up. He misinterprets this as a kidnapping and tackles the Crimson Dynamo, which sends Janice plummeting to the ground. And then Iron Man manages to catch her, and he does bring her to the ground safely. She's trying to tell Iron Man that the Crimson Dynamo isn't working with Titanium Man, but surprise, Tony Stark has no time to listen to a woman. And suddenly the Titanium Man arrives and blasts all three of them with a high-voltage electric beam. And that is especially bad news for anyone there who is not wearing high-tech armor. And Janice Cord dies in Iron Man's arms.
I could not believe this. I was completely caught unaware.
Yeah, it's pretty shocking. Because, again, we were promised death on the cover. We thought it was going to be Eddie Marsh. We just haven't seen a lot of supporting characters, especially supporting characters who have been in the book for a while. Like, she has been, you know, not a major supporting character, maybe, but she has been a significant character for a year or so.
Yeah, who else has been more consistently in this book than her? I can't think of anyone.
Yeah.
Yeah. Happy. I mean, she's been lately more than Happy or Pepper. So,
Happy's hardly in these.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so this is prior. At first I was like, oh my God, this is the first time this has happened. And this is still a couple of years before Gwen.
Yeah.
So I was like, oh, this is a huge thing. And then I started thinking about like the hero failing. And it happened in Captain Marvel recently. We just didn't care. Like, didn't care. Right. Like, it's just not
sticks
as impactful.
Were meh. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this seems like an escalation of like a more prominent, more important hero. Mm-hmm. Failing to save the lady love.
Yeah, totally agree. So Janice Cord, she dies in Iron Man's arms. Iron Man flies at the Titanium Man in a rage. The Dynamo gets to his feet. He sees Janice's body and he vows revenge on Iron Man. But he has to retreat because his armor is nearly destroyed after his one-on-one fight with the Titanium Man. So Iron Man tears into the Titanium Man. He's ripping chunks of wiring out of his armor. He drops him into the river where he sinks like a stone. And then the last panel shows Iron Man carrying the lifeless body of Janice Cord to a waiting ambulance. And that's how your story ends.
Yes. So, silently carrying the soft, still form toward an ambulance summoned too late.
Oof. Yeah.
Yeah.
Whew. Yeah. Truly, truly brutal and very surprising.
Yep. Point for Archie Goodwin.
He made us feel about Iron Man,
or at least near Iron Man.
Iron Man comic, I guess.
I think the other thing that's like also like as you kind of peel apart the story a little bit, like Iron Man is just he's wrong the entire time, you know. You don't have to look at it through much of a filter to see him as either he's the bad guy with all the stuff that he wound up doing that wound up ruining Alex Niven's life, including being partly responsible for the death of the woman that he loves. And then like she would have been safe if he hadn't attacked the Crimson Dynamo.
Yeah. And then if he had listened to her anywhere along the way, she's shouting throughout the whole comic to both of them, really, to knock it off.
Yeah.
If you think about the what if version that is the Crimson Dynamo comic from Marvel, Iron Man is utterly the villain in this.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, like I know we kind of touched on it a little bit before, but like, so, you know, obviously we're modern readers with our modern sensibilities and smarts and all that stuff, and the form has evolved. Like, this reads very easily as he's the bad guy. Like, do you think anyone at the time could read it that way, or is it just like not in the culture yet?
I would give Archie Goodwin enough credit that he knew what he was doing. I think he's going out of his way to assign some blame to Tony Stark here. Because the other thing is, like, as we've talked about, he has just struggled to try to make Iron Man an interesting character with some depth. And so it's like, okay, he fridges his girlfriend, which is, that's a way to to add some tragedy to his life, but also like by making him partly responsible for it and making him a more ambiguous character. You know, I've always said this is a total tangent, but over the years, Marvel has taken some of their classic villains and given them heroic turns. Like they've done it with Magneto, like
Doom.
Doom sometimes comes off as a hero, you know, in certain contexts. You've seen Dr. Octopus, you know, in Superior Spider-Man. Like,
oh, dude, even Sabretooth had several heroic runs, which is crazy.
Yeah, exactly. Right. But one thing, and listeners, if you can think of an example of this that I'm overlooking, I don't really know that Marvel has done the opposite, where they have taken someone who has been a hero for a long time and turned them villainous. And I really wish, like, I think Iron Man, Tony Stark is the character they could do that with. Like, I really wish that they had just made a decision after the first Civil War crossover. It's like, okay, well, let's make him a sympathetic and well-intentioned villain. Like,
yeah, you know, right.
You know, and just really lean in on that as a guy who he thinks he knows what's right. He thinks he knows better than anyone else what needs to be done. And he's wrong, but he's also got like almost infinite resources and he's a genius.
Yeah.
And he's not going to listen to anyone else.
Before the movie versions of that, I think the readership for Iron Man could have allowed them to be like, let's roll the dice on this and make Iron Man villainous. Because people, I mean, I don't know about both of you. Well, I do know about both of you, but we, my brother and I too, growing up, Iron Man was he was a rich guy with gadgets, you know, he was smart. And, there were things that like were Da Vinci interesting about him, but not otherwise. And also he was just a warmongering jerk. So, so was his dad. So who gives a crap about him? Make him a villain. Yeah, but it'd be cool at this point, you know, like whatever 5 years in to turn him to villain would be like just epically cool.
Yeah, because like, how different is he really than Dr. Doom? Like, you know, he's not a monarch and he's handsome.
Yeah.
But besides that, like, an argument could be made, you know?
Sure.
Yeah. And certainly Doom replaced him quite well for a while, you know, later as a hero, as questionable hero. But
Right.
I don't have a clever transition here, Jamie, but I would love to hear what Captain America was up to this month.
Sometimes the frog in the I don't know.
Really could start planning for these.
This is better.
This is way better. All right, we've got The Sting of the Scorpion, Captain America 122, written by Stan Lee, art by Gene Colan and Joe Sinnott. Steve spends 5 pages having an astonishingly complex inner debate about some like really complicated ideas, especially from this title, which has not done a ton of that. So he's kind of pondering like how this generation prefers and like maybe even needs more of an anti-hero over an establishment defender. And like if his whole Captain America shtick is outdated and lacks like a moral complexity that would like better symbolize what democracy really is and like how wrapped up he is, his identity with like patriotism. And like how maybe even patriotism is this antiquated concept. Like, I'm not being smart here. Like, he's saying these things. Like,
you're not reading into it. He is thinking all of this. Yeah.
Yeah. I get zero credit for this. Like, this is like on the page. Like, it seems like Stan's playing with some like big concepts here.
Well, I think Stan is struggling to make Captain America a relevant character during like the country has totally lost faith in the Vietnam War. Richard Nixon is in the White House. You know, it's like
Nixon and Vietnam happening right now and the rise of the hippies and Woodstock. And this is where Captain America, those 5 pages is the recurring theme of Captain America that makes me love Captain America.
Yeah.
Like I don't give a crap about the Boy Scout. Love the Captain America that tries to embody the complexity that is our country. And what liberty and freedom really mean, and more than just a soldier who does what he's told, but really considers everyone. And yeah, it's so I was so thrilled to read these 5 pages. Yeah.
Yeah. It's worth checking out the issue and just reading the 5 pages. I mean, you can take or leave the rest of the issue, but it's really fascinating. So he's kind of like going through all this and talking about if he should even represent an establishment that's it's so filled with like injustice and greed and war and all this. He's like walking through the streets, and then he gets home and it turns out he's really just sleepy and misses Sharon. So he like goes to bed.
Yep. Goes back to his flop house. Like
falls right on his face at the flop house. Yeah.
Yeah.
At the Chelsea. Yeah.
So then we cut to some crime people who are spying on a SHIELD phone call. They do the sexistly trash talking of Agent 13, who is his ex, Sharon. And they decide they're going to kill her, but they don't want to kill her themselves. They need somebody else to do it, so it can't be traced back to them. So this is like, you know, they're kind of hinting at who this might be. So this is like a pretty big mystery, unless you happen to have seen the cover of the comic, where once again, they tell you the thing that's going to happen. So then while Steve's sleeping, he has a nightmare and then like very crankily checks out of the hotel in the middle of the night, while the Scorpion is outside in the shadows waiting to attack any random person who happens to be walking by, just to kind of test out his new improved Scorpion abilities.
I like that his plan is to defeat a live victim. I feel like he's been beating up on dead victims.
Yeah, he's set a real low bar.
Yeah. Yeah.
I crunched the numbers on this just because I thought it was interesting. New York City in around 1970 had a population of 7,894,862 people. So Scorpion picks one at random to attack, and it happens to be Captain America. So
bad luck.
A superpower? Yeah. It's but either way, it's like, you know, maybe scorpions have more going on than we thought. So they briefly fight. And the Scorpion actually seems to be winning. Steve like punches a wall and really hurts his hand. But then the Fuzz show up and kind of scare the Scorpion off. So Steve heads back to the hotel room to change into his costume. What is interesting, the only reason I actually bring this up is because as he's putting on the costume, he starts talking about how that makes him feel like the real him. And the art does a great job of his evolving his posture. Mm-hmm. So like those five pages where he's walking through the streets, he's like punched and his neck is crooked, and it's just, he's very like angular and sad, and like as he's putting this costume on, it just like, he's just like a puppet standing up like super straight all of a sudden, and it's, he looks like heroic and Captain America.
Yeah he looks like he's utterly like a shaggy posture. Mm-hmm. Just to mention, yeah. Scooby-Doo, since we haven't so far.
yeah we've been recording
somehow we're getting now. That sweet Scooby-Doo money.
Oh, and a friend of mine actually pointed out that Scooby is a DC property.
Oh crap!
So we're bringing people together here. That's
the month. We're building bridges.
There you go.
Building bridges made of giant dogs.
Gross. all right. So anyway, Cap, he sees Scorpion get into a car, and this car is like equipped with a fancy TV that they make a point of. And so Steve hops in a taxi. And is following the Scorpion in his car. So we learn that the Scorpion is actually the one who's hunting for Sharon, in case you hadn't figured that out by now. And Sharon is currently hunting those guys, the crime guys from earlier in the issue. So the Cap shows up and attacks the Scorpion, who's like, what? Like, how is Captain America involved in any of this? Which totally makes sense from his perspective. Cap eventually beats the Scorpion by using the one thing that every Scorpion fears, a bent tree used like a rubber band.
Just like pulls a sapling back and whacks him in the face with it.
Yeah, it stings.
Nice. Yeah, he boyoyoyoings himself to victory.
Fatang. Fatang, yep. Is the sound effect. Yeah.
Yeah, really funny moment.
Yep.
So meanwhile, the crime people figure out that the Scorpion has failed, but they manage to capture Sharon all by themselves anyway. Cap bursts into the room. Sharon is tied up in a closet, basically, or in a cellar, and she has a mouth gag on. So the way she's figured out to get the gag off is to rub her mouth gag against the rough edge of a barrel.
Yeah, it's just a weird note that we need to know which thing she used to get that gag out of the mouth.
And given how the timing of the last couple pages pan out, it actually kind of makes sense, because it couldn't be quick. It needs to take her a long time to do it.
Right.
Because as she's doing that, Cap has like beaten all the bad guys, and then SHIELD shows up and they're like, all right, hey, bud, you're done. Go get in this taxi from earlier.
And Cap has no idea that he's saving Sharon. He has no idea that she's there. All he knows is this is a supervillain. I'm going to take him down. Like he heard the Scorpion talking about like doing some job and like going to get, you know, he's going to charge him double. So he knows he's up to no good, but he's like, he's just kind of indifferent. He's like, oh, crime needs stopping, so I'm just going to stop some crime. Yeah.
Yeah. He doesn't necessarily know what the crime people are up to. Like he just walks into a mansion and is like, eh, you guys are wearing fedoras. Like we're going to fight. Oh, do you have a bag with the dollar sign on it? But Sharon has heard all this fighting, so she knows that he was there. So she's like trying frantically to get gagged so that she can call to him, but she's too late. And that makes her very sad because he drives off in the cab.
Yeah.
And then Cap is in the cab, and the cab driver points out like that Cap looks sad and dejected, and he looks like he just lost his best gal pal or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
That's a running theme. Like, check this segue out. We've got a guy who pretty much ends up the same way every issue, just reminiscing about how he screwed up his relationship or possible engagement even.
Oh, and who is that guy, Rob?
That guy's called Matt Murdock, attorney at law. Yeah. Daredevil. Let me take you through the showdown.
Let me tell you about another guy who has relationship trouble. Rob gets up, turns his chair around, straddles it. A fellow by the name of Daredevil.
I was trying to segue and it just ended up taking so long. It was
That was way better than my just, it's like, screw it. I'm not even going to punt.
I like it. I just love this game of either ruin the segue or try to get one. That's just our jam for the omnibus episodes.
Yeah, we need a point system.
Yeah. Yep. So this is Daredevil number 60. Showdown at Sea is the title, written by Roy Thomas, art by Gene Colan, and Sid Shores doing the finishes. I have to say, I like Sid Shores doing the finishes more than Joe Sinnott. We talked about this last issue, but on Cap, Joe was doing the finishes. And although Joe is great on Fantastic Four with Kirby, it's so weird when he's doing the inking on Gene's, you know, penciling. So
yeah.
Sid does more of a, what you would expect, a little more creepy, a little more weird, a little more dark. And speaking of dark, we begin tonight's adventure with Daredevil beating a couple of thugs up on the docks. Just classic Daredevil. They have some loot for a ship out beyond the 12-mile limit is what we find out. And one is named Shades McGraw.
Yeah. Shades.
And he not only has a similar facial structure to Matt Murdock, but he somehow, Matt feels the hair color and does a quick dye job to match it up.
With some chemicals that he keeps in his pocket.
Yeah.
In case he needs to do a quick dye job. What do you guys not understand?
I need to get rid of this gray, and I should have considered the chemicals I keep in my pocket. So Daredevil as Shades takes the loot out to the big ship and driving the small boat and reminisces about recent events while he drives toward the destination somehow. Because
good point.
Flying guy on a boat with no idea where he's headed.
I love it when Daredevil drives something.
Yeah, it's like driving a car seems like he could echolocate more, but when he got out on the ocean, I was like, what in the hell? How is he going to do this?
Yep.
But
you
it
got
was
a boat
no
motor going. You got water. And
yeah.
Then, yeah.
There's not a lot of stuff to figure out your location. And anyway, I didn't. The point is, let's just reminisce with Matt Murdock. He thinks about recent events with Crime Wave, who is not the wave of crime, but a person who is the running a wave of crime. So just right on the nose. And his hitman, Stuntmaster, who recently tried to kill him at a parade with his flying motorcycle that landed on him. And the unforgettable Torpedo.
Our personal favorite.
All right.
Yeah.
We are the new greatest villains that we did stuff. So, and a little incident with Foggy's new assistant named Hollis, who is recommending in this, you know, memory that Foggy break off his engagement with Debbie Harris to improve his public image for possible reelection.
Right. Because she has a record, a criminal record.
Yeah.
has this guy been around for a while? And I didn't remember.
That's funny. You should mention it. I was like, wait, who's this Hollis guy?
Yeah, he probably won't turn out to be anyone important.
I guess he's been his assistant. We probably just missed him in 40 other issues. Or at least 5 since he's been DA, but you know.
Right. Yeah.
His special lady friend, fiance, do we know about her record? Do we know?
This goes back to, not the master planner. What was
the what trapper was the guy, keeper? I can't remember.
Yeah. You know what we're talking about. Yeah.
He lost me a torpedo.
Yeah. She was someone who Foggy was sweet on in his younger years, and she was manipulated to betray him on behalf of someone who is like a criminal mastermind
in the Magia. Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe. Okay. I don't know. Yeah.
But then she had a change of heart but still did some time.
All right. But heart of gold.
Something like that. Yeah.
So Hollis is saying, you know, you got to break up with her. You're fiance because she's an ex-con. Debbie gets upset and just gives him back the ring and breaks off the engagement and storms out. And then she gets a picture taken from some paparazzi guy in the right outside the office door. She takes off. Then Matt does an insanely quick change and changes into Daredevil, beats the photographer to the lobby where I assume there was an elevator ride involved, and then bumps into him as Daredevil and causes the film to get exposed and ruined.
Very cool. It was a cool moment.
Shades McGraw, who is Matt Murdock, arrives at the big boat now. So we're done reminiscing and takes a proverbial peek around. He quickly susses out that the roulette wheel on this floating casino that's inside this big ship is rigged with some kind of magnet. And then he immediately gets put in charge of the roulette wheel, which is just weird. And then he noticed that his best friend and co-worker's fiance, or former fiance, Debbie Harris, is playing at that wheel. But apparently she's too into winning to notice anything about the wheel operator. And also his hair is a slightly different red color.
A slightly different color. Yeah.
So wouldn't notice it was Matt. So... Yeah. She's winning great. And that's because Matt/Shades is not allowing any cheating to happen. He's not pushing the button to make the magnet engage. But Crime Wave, in his infinite overseer wisdom, notices this on his casino level security cameras and overrides the wheel from his control center. And so because he overrides the roulette wheel, Debbie loses. And then some security like people come and take her away to talk to management about the 10 G's she owes them now. So her upturn wasn't very long, I guess. Daredevil or Shades/Matt, he's always got like 4 secret identities at any given moment. So Matt changes into Daredevil costume, follows, and takes a side mission to disable the ship's captain and tie up the ship's wheel.
Some very, very Metal Gear Solid action here.
As he's headed back, we see Debbie get taken to the management office, meet Crime Wave, and pull off Crime Wave's mask. And we know that she recognizes who Crime Wave is. Then a bunch of confusing fighting occurs with Melvin and others, because for some reason, all the henchmen are dressed exactly like Daredevil without a mask.
Yeah.
And there's like a couple pages where I'm just like, what in the hell is happening?
Yeah, it's so confusing.
It's like Daredevil brought henchmen to fight him. But it's super weird. They are dressed like something went wrong in the inking or in the coloring. Because I don't think they're supposed to all look exactly like Daredevil.
No, I don't think so.
So Daredevil fights a bunch of goons. He almost gets killed by a laser, but does a trademark turn out the lights thing and then takes care of a bunch more. And then Crime Wave, because he's got all these buttons in his special console, turns on security lights, but not fast enough for DD to mow through a few more. And as he's getting close to Crime Wave, he has to end up protecting Debbie and probably about to get shot by a laser because he either has to protect her or get to Crime Wave, and he's going to protect her.
Right.
But right then, Crime Wave gets suddenly shot by a cop. Yeah. I love that. It's just like, he just gets bam. And I'm like, what happened now? Off screen. He just got hit, shot by a cop. We cut to the next panel and it's Foggy and a cop. Apparently, authorities have arrived because Daredevil steered the boat out of the 12-mile international waters mark so that it was in the jurisdiction where they could apprehend him. And guess what? Crime Wave was Hollis all along.
We've been wringing our hands
trying to figure out if Hollis might be Crime Wave from all of the clues in all of the issues that he wasn't in. And here we are. So
this is a constant Daredevil problem. Like, things just happen. Like, he just deduces things. People are just obviously in the FBI or whatever. Like, like, there's so many things this book has going for it. And like, consecutive reasoning is really not one of them.
I do think one thing that Gene Colan had a reputation for is he would not read the full script that was handed to him before he started drawing it. So, and not that it was like traditional full script, but like there'd be a story outline. He wouldn't read the whole thing. He would just start drawing as he was reading, and he'd get to a part that he really liked and he would blow it out. And then he'd realize it's like, oh, I'm 17 pages into this, and now I have to fit the other half of the story into these last three pages. So,
That would create this kind of systemic.
Yeah. So there is a lot of sort of like, wow, we just got to make some real quick leaps, to move this story forward, to a satisfying conclusion.
That is really good advice for anybody who, like, I probably could fall prey to that pretty easily if I was drawing a comic. Like, I would just be like, this scene is awesome. I'm going to just start drawing it. And then, I'm five pages in and I'm doing something else. And then suddenly I realize I painted myself into a corner because. And so that, I mean, this is good for aspiring, you know, comic artists. Just read the whole, and in Marvel's case, the like one page outline of this entire
issue. Not a lot of reading,
but I understand that it's a whole page. I don't want to read that. So anyway, we end up with Daredevil. As I mentioned at the top of this piece, he's bummed. He's driving away. Everyone, as usual, is like, man, you got it made. You caught everybody. Nothing's wrong for you. And he's like just maudlin and looking out the window and thinking about Karen Page and how he might see her in the crowd. So
it's sad when, you know, a couple that should be together just can't quite make it happen. Let's cleanse our palate from that by talking about a couple that is definitely going to wind up together by the end of this issue, because it's all about their wedding day.
Yeah. Nice segue, man.
This issue, it's Incredible Hulk number 124, The Rhino Says No. It's written by Roy Thomas. The art is by Herb Trimpe and Sal Buscema. And on the cover of this issue, we see the Hulk busting out of his tuxedo as Betty Ross in her wedding dress and a minister look on in horror. And in the foreground, we see the Rhino. And all of this is very weird because I'm pretty sure the Hulk killed the Rhino in Hulk 103. He said so himself. And also, Bruce Banner promised Betty last issue that he'd never turn into the Hulk again. So I don't know what to tell you. Anyway, the issue begins with the leader reading a newspaper with the headline, Bruce Banner to marry. Just very similar to Dr. Doom reading the newspaper in the Fantastic Four annual where we read and Sue get married. This is how supervillains find out about their nemesis nuptials.
Sure. No internet.
Leader spies on Betty and Bruce taking a moonlit boat ride down a river, and he decides not to kill them because what fun would that be? Instead, he wants to get the Hulk to kill Betty on their wedding day.
Damn,
it's cold, leader. And then he mentally goes through his set of Hulk villain trading cards to figure out who he could get to do the deed. After dismissing A-listers like the Submariner and Mandarin and the Space Parasite, he decides that the Rhino is the man-beast for the job. And from yet another newspaper clipping, I just assume he's got a clipping service, you know, who's just like cutting out like anything like Hulk related and like puts a folder together for him every month and sends it. But we learn that the Rhino didn't die in Hulk 103. He was captured near death and he's being kept under sedation and heavy guard at the state hospital because it turns out the Hulk is not medically qualified to evaluate the physical condition of man rhinos. So the leader sends that big dumb android he's got to go kidnap the comatose rhino from the hospital. We thought we'd seen the end of it.
But I hoped we'd seen the end of it, but he's still here.
Meanwhile, General Ross tells Bruce Banner that he had him pegged totally wrong. He wants them to be married in the house where Betty was born. He even calls Bruce son. So, I mean, life really just cannot get any better for this happy couple. And speaking of happy couples, the leader revives the rhino and gives him new rhino jammies, and then he puts their plan into action. As Bruce and Betty's wedding begins, the leader and rhino pull up in an oil truck outside. Are they conspicuous? A guy with a giant green head and a guy in a rhino costume driving an oil tanker truck? No, because Rhino is wearing an overcoat and he's hunching a little
bit. Yeah, he's got the collar popped. It's fine. Right. So yeah.
I'd watch that show for sure. He's too on a long cross-country road trip.
I would watch it if they were just like oil delivery men.
Yeah.
That was literally their job. Like they're on parole and they're just trying not to screw it up. But anyway, the tanker, surprise, surprise, is not actually full of oil. It is full of a gamma cannon, and it opens up, and leader takes aim at Bruce and blasts him in the middle of his wedding, and it causes him to Hulk out. The leader is seconds away from getting exactly what he wanted. He just needs to hit Hulk with one more blast. It's going to make him completely savage, and he'll almost certainly just crush everyone around him, Betty included. But that's when the rhino just can't contain himself any longer, and he charges into the house.
Leroy Jenkins. Yeah.
Yep. So, you know, leader doesn't have a clear shot anymore. So the Hulk and Rhino start going at it, and they absolutely demolish the house that Betty grew up in. So this day is just really taking a turn. The leader tries to blast Hulk again, but he gets the Rhino instead, and Rhino's not happy about that. He charges at the leader's truck, and the leader tries to escape in a little flying bubble craft that apparently was hidden in the cab of the truck, but the Rhino grabs onto it as it soars upwards, and it explodes. Hulk is just going to call it a win, and he just wanders off, and a heartbroken Betty watches her injured father loaded into an ambulance.
I love that. I love that Hulk, when he calls it a win, literally does. He says, Hulk do nothing at end, but still Hulk won. I like it.
Yeah.
Hulk can't keep a lot in his head, but he definitely keeps his win-loss record straight.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. In the last panel, we see that Major Glenn Talbot is right there to take Betty in his arms, of course, because he's just a shameless little weasel.
That guy.
Yeah. Opportunist. That's your Hulk action. And Jamie, I was going to try to come up with a transition to get you to Silver Surfer, but I'm looking at the title of this and I realize I read this issue. I took screenshots of this issue for our social.
Silver Surfer issue.
I have absolutely no recollection of this story.
Oh, well. I was like, wait, what in the hell is happening in this? I read it too.
Well, allow me to assist you with a summary containing more words than the actual comic. This is my specialty. All right, we've got Silver Surfer number 12, Gather Ye Witches, by Stan Lee and John Buscema. So we open on some witches. Doing probably exactly what you're picturing when I say witches. So they are stirring a cauldron over a fire and chanting.
I remember this one. I could have said, Rhino is not exactly a classic Hulk villain. You know who is a classic Hulk villain? The Abomination. What's he been up to lately?
Right.
There we go.
We had a clear path there.
Luckily, you're the editor. Yeah.
Yeah. I was just 2 minutes late, but we came in. Yeah.
Better late than never.
Yeah. Anyway. Continue. Wait. Witches.
Yeah, so these kooky witches, they summon something like wispy and smoky, but then it kind of goes away, which seemed a little anticlimactic at the moment, but they chalk this up as a pretty big win because I guess they're kind of like new to this witchery stuff. So go Team Witch. They're doing it. the Warlock Prime, as he's called, who he's just kind of orchestrated this whole thing, he's aggravated. He's really angry because it seems like this witch stuff isn't being taken seriously by the world, and like he's resentful that they have to be so secretive. So for a sec, you get this whole like, oh, we're hated and feared outcasts. So you're like, oh, maybe these guys are okay. But then like literally a panel later, he starts talking about how knowledge is power and we have all the power and we're going to prove it to all those jerks. And so like you get that he's bad real quick.
Yeah. And yeah. They're just kind of like rich dilettantes. Like,
yeah.
Yeah. So I also like that they're near Stonehenge. That's one of the things it says, because anytime it's like Stonehenge and where the druids are, it just reminds me of Spinal Tap.
No, Stonehenge is one of the top henges that I am aware of.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So all these witches are like greasy and pointy looking. They look pretty unpleasant. The wife of the Warlock Prime is very worried about him because he picked up all this witchcraft stuff as kind of like a goof at first, but now he's like making people hail him, and like he's throwing out words like master, and just you can tell where this is going, and it's not great.
Yeah. I mean, he's like maybe 2 weeks away from making everyone throw their keys in a bowl when they come over to his house. So yeah.
Or yeah, some kind of swastika stuff, you know, it's one of the one way right, or the other. Right. Yeah.
That's not necessarily an either or.
Yeah, that's true.
I was going to make a model train analogy, but you guys have an handle. So meanwhile, in this issue of the Silver Surfer, he is having kind of his usual space sadgasm over recent Shalabal events, you know, where he lost her once again. He sent her back in the ship injured, and he can't leave Earth. But he's had enough of that. So he's going to try and speed through the barrier that's been keeping him trapped here.
That he's tried to do many times before.
Yeah. So he gets a Looney Tunes really big running start, slams into the thing, knocks himself out, and crashes to the Earth like a meteor, where he's captured by the witch guy. Whose name is Nigel, by the way.
Nigel.
Yeah. If that doesn't, inspire terror into the hearts of man, I don't know what does. He's also a jerk to his chauffeur. So we like have 100% proof that this guy's a jerk.
Yeah. You can tell a lot by the way people treat the help.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So now Nigel has captured an unconscious surfer and is going to use the surfer to prove to the world how glorious witches are, like somehow. The surfer wakes up in like a pretty lavish room wearing a sweet robe, and like immediately starts talking trash about how humans can't be trusted and how everyone sucks, and just like betrayals everywhere. But Nigel walks in and tut-tuts him. He tells him that's not true. Humans can totally be trusted. Here, have some of this tea, which is drugged, and immediately knocks the surfer out once again.
Because he can get drugged by drugged earth tea. Yeah.
Yeah. And like this amount of betrayals, why this guy hasn't nuked the entire planet is completely beyond me. Like,
yeah,
he has seen the worst of humanity time and time again. So now that he's unconscious, the witches all gather to summon what turns out to be the Abomination. And the Abomination had been like strange napped by the Stranger in a Hulk issues a bunch of bit back. I don't really remember that.
Well, there was the stretch. It was the first appearance of the Abomination. There's a stretch of Marvel Comics where if you couldn't figure out how to end a story, you just had the Stranger kidnap the villain.
He just shows up and grabs him.
It's just like
Professor X brain blasts everyone, or the Stranger just takes the villain somewhere else.
Yeah.
By Magneto. Yeah. Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. So that's what happened to the Abomination.
Okay. Yeah. So yeah, for years now, the Abomination's been in a tube or whatever it is the Stranger does with people. We don't want to ask too many questions about that. So the witches have summoned the Abomination. The Abomination arrives there and like immediately betrays them and tries to take over the Earth. So he beats up the witches pretty easily and gravely injures head witch Nigel.
This is a victimless crime.
Yeah, yes. But I do love in the Marvel Universe that witches can try to summon a demon, and they get a gamma irradiated monster who has been stolen by a space alien.
Yep.
And that's fine. That's like the spell still works. You got something, you know,
right.
But
it's
that's
like
how the Marvel Universe is. It's just like Doctor Strange can be like, I need help. And you know, like say all this stuff about the moons of Moonipore or something. And then suddenly like Iron Man is summoned, or just a robot. You know, yeah, a satanic robot, right. But I don't know.
Nailed it again.
Yeah.
Another successful summoning.
Anyway, sorry, you're so bad at magic, amateur.
That struck me as very like doomish. Like, it just science and magic are the same. It doesn't matter. Do your spell, something will happen.
Yep.
Well, and didn't there was another summoning a couple issues back in Silver Surfer where someone was trying to summon someone and got a demon instead, or a pirate, ghost, witch man.
Yeah, they got the Flying Dutchman.
Yeah, exactly. So a lot of summoning in this book.
Yeah.
All right. So the surfer wakes up and sees that Nigel is hurt, and because he's Jesus-y, gives up, is willing to sacrifice himself for someone else. Very cool surfer action. Uh-huh. And he's immediately repaid for his kindness by getting talked into hunting the abomination for these witches. Or at least that's what Nigel wants.
Right.
The surfer is kind of like, my name's Paul, shit's between y'all. and flies away because he's been duped, and now he's given his energy over to somebody else. So enough's enough, which lasts for a minute until he sees the carnage from above. He's like, all right, I guess I will help. Even though he's very weak.
Right.
So then comes a very cool looking fight sequence. I think this is cool, A, because the number of panels, there's a lot of panels per page, if I'm remembering right. Uh-huh. And you've got the surfer, who is silver or whitish, and then you've got the abomination, who is green. And what they do is they throw them on these solid colored backgrounds. Uh-huh. So you got your pinks, your yellows, your orange and blues, and everything just like pops. It's very cool. So they do that for like a page or maybe two, or it went on maybe a little longer than maybe
like
two.
Three and a half.
Yeah. a lot of fights, but it looked nice, so I didn't mind. The surfer wins this fight, but then sort of strangely gives the abomination back to the witches because like he can't be bothered with at this point. He's like, you guys suck. I'm done with you. And then like flies sadly back into orbit to like mourn, to just be sad about things, really. He doesn't fit in with anyone. Shalabal's gone.
Yep. People keep summoning abominations to beat him up.
Yeah, rude. Which makes this, how many have we done this week? The fourth, the fifth comic?
Yeah, something like that.
Mm-hmm. And they all have ended the exact same way, with the hero being very sad. And even though they won the fight, which led me to wonder if Marvel Comics are depressing. Like, are they like 49% sad and that's why they're good? Like, is DC doing this? Are DC Comics sad?
Or everybody's just high-fiving at the end, like, bam, yeah.
Another job well done.
Mixoplex is gone. Let's do this somewhere. Let's have some drinks back at JLA. Yeah.
Yeah. I feel like part of it is it's sort of like an adolescent view of, like, what a mature story is, which is that it has to end with a bummer, you know? Like, it has to end on a down note. I do think this is also just, like, the Marvel formula is becoming...
Mm-hmm.
It's not being as skillfully concealed, you know?
Yeah, right. You shouldn't see the strings so much as you do.
Right. Yeah. But it is like everyone now is Spider-Man. It's like if the hero wins, then the civilian identity has to lose.
Yeah. And increasingly, that's been ramping up slowly but surely in Daredevil. I think that's like the most clear escalation of that we've seen.
Yeah.
And now with Iron Man 2, and now Janice Cord's died. So now you've got that there too.
Yeah, I mean, and with Daredevil, it's especially conspicuous because, like, you really get that whole, like, moping about Karen Page just really getting shoehorned in the very last panel. Like, there's no reason for that to, to even show up. It's a total non sequitur. The issue that I've got here, this one does kind of break the pattern. It is Submariner number 22. The Monarch and the Mystic, written by Roy Thomas, art by Marie Severin and Johnny Craig. I'm going to start this out by saying that I will take issues that only exist to wrap up dangling plot threads from a canceled series for $100, Alex. You remember... I'm sorry, Rob. It's still very...
It's still an open wound losing Alex Trebek for us in our house. Yeah.
You are a big Jeopardy fan. Yeah. That was insensitive of me, and I apologize.
And also 100, I think you should go for 200. That's a better number. But
okay. Excellent. Well, so you guys remember Doctor Strange, right?
Nope. No, okay. I'm wearing a Doctor Strange shirt, but I don't remember Doctor Strange.
Right, yeah.
No, I don't remember that. I do remember Saunders, Doctor Saunders. That rings more of a recent bell.
Right. Well, the comic used to be called Strange Tales, and it switched to Doctor Strange with issue number 169, and then the last issue that we read was 183, which hit the stands in August of 1969. I don't know that I realized this at the time, but that was the last issue of that series. And it ended on a heck of a cliffhanger. It featured our favorite Doctor Strange supporting character, a telegram that an old friend of his sent to Stephen Saunders. Saunders?
I think it's Saunders.
Yeah. Saunders, yes.
Right. I
can't
mess that up.
Which is that's what Eternity changed his civilian name to, because Eternity really wanted Doctor Strange to have a secret identity, apparently.
And not a cool name anymore.
Yeah. Right.
Also very briefly.
Very briefly. Yeah. So the doc arrived at his friend Kenneth Ward's home, only to find him extremely ill. His home was filled with very suspicious housekeeping staff who turned out to be demons in search of a lost idol. Strange destroyed them with sunlight, but they promise that the undying ones will find what they sought. Is any of this ringing a bell?
Oh, yeah.
Only because I've read this issue of Submariner, but no.
The LSD fight.
You know, right.
Yeah, I remember the telegram that was like two whole issues of Doctor Strange.
How could you forget that telegram? Yeah. That telegram, should have been spun off into its own series.
It's like the bill on Capitol Hill.
Yeah, that's what I'm picturing, with like little legs. And
yeah, well, anyway, I was going to say, apparently Roy Thomas had what he thought was an absolutely killer follow-up, but also I think this also might just be that series may have just gotten canceled kind of unexpectedly, and Roy wanted to actually give, like, kind of tie the character off and give him like a heroic moment to go out on, rather than just like, well, this issue ended and there's not going to be another one. So since Doctor Strange was canceled, he takes the story and he sticks it in Submariner. So the story begins with Namor returning to Atlantis and getting a hand-waving operation to restore his water-breathing and feet-winging abilities. And while he's under, he hallucinates a macabre idol and a bunch of demons attacking cavemen, and Doctor Strange is doing his best Uatu-style narration to describe the history of what's going on here. The idol is the gateway to a demon realm, so forth and so
blah,
on.
Blah, 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 blah.
Yeah, so... Namor wakes up and immediately swims to Boston, where he steals some clothes and makes his way to Kenneth Ward's home. And he's greeted by Ward's daughter, but Doctor Strange's ethereal voiceover tells Namor to check out the den, which is totally trashed. Suddenly a demon attacks him, but Namor punches it until it disappears into a mist. He finds Ward's daughter unconscious, he helps her out, and then he finds a riddle written on the back of the portrait. And through adventure game logic, it leads him to a nearby graveyard where he lifts up a monument and he finds the idol underneath it. It's like Resident Evil 2 style puzzling.
Yeah, it's not as complicated as Tomb Raider, but yeah.
Right.
He also turns blue for three panels. Did he turn blue for three panels? Did you see that?
Namor?
In the graveyard? Yeah.
Yeah. That's just him in the darkness. He looks like he goes bald for a second too. There's some weird inking on those top three panels on page 12. He's lifting the monument to John Goodwin, which I don't know if that has any, if it's some Marvel in joke, but yeah, those three panels are just bizarrely inked.
Yeah, he was a magistrate at Salem's witch trials. And so that's, this apparently has something to do with, I didn't read it really closely.
it's not a read.
It's okay.
Real
we're going to give
issue.
You a pass yeah. on this yeah. one. Yeah.
Yeah. So, Doctor Strange suddenly shows up. And he grabs the idol that Namor has just revealed. And then he reveals that Ward's daughter is also a demon, because Ward never had a daughter. It was just she was the devil in disguise. Mm-hmm. So Doctor Strange recaps his final issue for Namor. And as he's doing so, Ward's daughter's cat creeps up to the idol and touches it, because the cat's a demon too. Everyone's a demon. Everyone in the story
you're
is
saying
a demon.
Is like triggering me to almost like, when you say Devil in Disguise, the Elvis song, just like, yep. She's a devil in disguise. Just, it's like a trigger for me. I almost can't let it go by. And I didn't.
You got anything with Devil Cats, or can we just keep going?
No, I bought a shirt for Barb that says how to take care of your demon cat. But that's, wow. That's all. Yeah.
Welcome to the free association part of our show. So anyway, Cat touches idol, opens a rift to Demon Town, and they fight some demons. The rift starts to close, but only one of them can go back through it. The other one has to hold off the demons. So Doctor Strange heroically sends the guy who still has a series back through the rift and sacrifices himself to hold off the demons. And that is the heroic sacrifice of Doctor Strange. Pour out a little liquor for him. We will not see his like again.
Pour it into my mouth.
A little while. Yes. There you go. Well, yeah. As soon as you're done with that, you got some work to do here, Rob. You got to tell us about the immortal and the mind slave.
Yeah, I will. I'm going to do that. this is quite an issue of Thor. It's number 172 by Stan Lee with Jack Kirby and Bill Everett.
Still no Vince Coletta.
No Coletta. And it's still a little weird not having him after this long. I have to say, I feel like I may have given him with Larry Lieber, may have given somebody too much crap on my podcast.
I didn't
know was going to go this long or have people actually listen to.
You can't take it back too.
Yeah, that's, I know, it's part. There. It's fine. I'll live with what I say. I'm going to take that from Chelsea Kane. Like, I said it, I meant it at the time.
I said what I said.
Yeah. I love that. Yeah. So this issue starts with Thor arriving outside the office of lame Dr. Blake to find out that Dr. Jim North is waiting inside. Dr. North, I will remind you, is the guy who Odin helped Jane Foster fall in love with and also go work for when Jane couldn't handle Asgard and being Thor's girlfriend or lame Dr. Blake in general.
Because in the mind of Stan Lee, going to work for and falling in love with a doctor is just something that a nurse does in 1969.
That's what happens. It's the same thing.
Yeah. Yep.
So it turns out this is just such a weird issue.
It is very strange.
Some creepy billionaire has taken Jane hostage in order to get Dr. North to come do some experimental and forbidden operation on him. And North is there because he wants lame Dr. Blake to get in touch with Thor, because everybody knows they're somehow related, and see if he can help. So we get a little break where Odin takes a look around the universe and discusses the
Let's
peril.
Check in on our subplots. Yeah.
I love it because he makes like a guy hold, he makes his counselor hold up a thing that he can look through. So it's like
an Enchanti scan.
Yeah. The Enchanti scan is like a basically an iMac that runs on magic, and some guy has to hold up for Odin to look at. So basically this is all just a quick aside so Odin can up the stakes and say that Thor is in great peril. And if the counselor's like, well, what, you're not going to do anything about it? What if your son dies? And he's like, I will drown Asgard in my tears. I'm like, oh, cool.
You could kill all of us.
Yeah, you're very weird for an omniscient guy. Yeah.
Yeah, you could just help.
Yeah. Yeah, omnipotent and omniscient. So, yeah.
Yeah.
And no crying really necessary when you're sitting in that particular seat.
Yeah. So Dr. North finally gets to the heavily fortified castle and meets our creepy billionaire Cronin Krask.
$10 says I know which of the creative partners named that guy.
Cronin Kirby. He's like a walrus-like evil billionaire.
When I first saw him, I thought it was Falstaff, like playing a joke.
Yeah, yeah. Looks like Baron Harkonnen from the Lynch Dune movie with a big old like cop mustache. But
yeah, with the Stranger's mustache, actually.
Yeah. I don't know. There's something about Kirby and giant mustaches. He just is. That's a villain thing for Kirby.
Mm-hmm.
And I agree. I've never enjoyed just a giant mustache. It makes me think it's a cop and I'm in trouble. So yeah. Cronin Krask is, he reveals that the doctor is going to help him. He has all the power in the world, all the money in the world, but he doesn't have immortality. So the Dr. North is going to help him become immortal, or, you know, they're going to kill Jane. But Doc North defiantly pulls a gun on Krask. But everybody, there's all these guards. They threaten Jane some more, who is in the room. So North backs down and agrees to do the deal. We also learn that the only other doctor with the missing knowledge to make all of this immortality brain stuff happen was previously abducted and forced to do Krask's bidding. Because North is like, there's no way I can do it without this guy's work. And he's like, oh, we already got that guy and made him set this up. So all you have to do is this.
Did you see my Slack post? I tried to look this guy up because I thought maybe they were referencing a scientist at the time who had been trying to do brain stuff. Anyway, it just seemed like maybe it was a science reference. Mm-hmm. So I looked it up. I misspelled it, of course, because I'm an idiot. And then, but Google was like, oh, did you actually mean this guy? Because if you did, he's from Thor. Issue. I was like, wow, Google, well done.
Jeez. No, it's a, yeah, it's a bonkers thing. So we'll get to that here shortly. But Thor, who's it's his book. He finally gets to business and starts his attack on Krask's fortress. We're about halfway through the issue, but in a twist, we find out that Trask wanted Thor to show up and had a special gun made that basically shoots him with a weaponized hallucinogen. And
yeah, I love
so Thor gets super dosed and falls asleep. I always love those, like, you know what? Let's just spray mushrooms on the Hulk and see what happens. So it turns out
three pages later, this is a terrible idea. Yeah.
He's tripping balls. So it turns out Krask, being the crappy evil billionaire he is, won't settle to just have his mind put into a young, healthy person like any other rich person getting their mind transplanted into someone. His goal is to have his brain put into a certain god who we, you know, it's Thor. So North hems and haws, but they threaten Jane some more and then he gets to work. So, and it's not wet work, which was a surprise. I thought this was going to be like chopping open the old Calvarium and getting in there. But it's brain waves that get shot together with your, you know, basic run-of-the-mill ultra oscilloscope, and then in that crackly place, the brain swapping takes place. It's it's science, kids.
And like their astral forms are like punching each other.
Yeah, brain waves get into a wrestling match, and
which, like, you hope that's how it would really work.
Yes.
You know, like, I want the dominant brain wave shape embodiment. That's the one that should win.
I think I've trained for that and not the actual wrestling. So exactly. I'm hoping
that's why we're in favor of it.
Yeah. We're all in favor
of the nerd.
Yeah. The brain. Well,
and you can see how, like, Krask thought he probably had a fighting chance because, I mean, we have read some Thor stories where he has made some very stupid decisions.
Yeah.
Like if this is just a battle of, you know, minds, then it could be a 50-50.
If the dude had picked Johnny Storm, bam, he is the Human Torch. Yeah,
he'd have a healthy teenage body that could combust at a moment's notice.
Yeah, this is kind of a nerd dream. It's like brain wrestling instead of arm wrestling. I've got a shot at this.
Solid plan.
Yeah. So Thor, it turns out, has the strongest brain. I guess Krask was just too busy thinking about money and immortality and not about the finer things in life. But and also Thor's been around for a lot longer than Krask. Maybe we haven't seen evidence of it, but maybe he's learned more.
Also mustache wax back then was very toxic. You don't hear about that.
So that probably weakened his brain. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah.
Well, and then we find out on the last page that Dr. North says, to Thor, I'm a doctor. I knew you weren't really in a coma. I could tell you were feigning unconsciousness. Why did you go through with it? Why did you take the chance? And Thor says, it was a challenge. A challenge no warrior couldst ignore. He's on shrooms.
Like,
I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's like, I had a chance to brain fight a rich guy and I'm going to fight him.
Yeah.
With my brain.
Or I think he's probably more on LSD, but yeah, he's just like, yeah, it's still a fight. I mean, come on.
Yep.
So,
and he punched his brain to death.
Yeah. Crash keels over dead. Like they're just like, he falls out of his strapped in, you know, table and he is dead. So, there, another big villain is going to live forever.
He died the way he lives with a giant mustache.
He fell right on his mustache.
Put his portrait up next to Torpedo's.
Yeah. Oh.
The stars that burn twice as bright, half as long.
Oh, you almost made me pee my pants. But also before Thor, leaves, he consoles Jane and North, and because they're like, man, we almost let your brain get wrestled away. So he's like, there's nothing else you could do. You did the right thing. And then he just walks out. Like, I just love, it's just Thor walking out the door. He's like, all right, well, later. And that's it. Problem solved. Ooh, dead guy actually, with a mustache. Yeah.
Yeah. And if you think about it, he like, that's his lady, right? I mean, like, that's Jane with another guy.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, ostensibly, this is another issue where the semi heartbroken or dumped or sad about a lady walks in. I mean, that's subtextual in this case, but
right,
he probably doesn't want to watch them smooch.
Well, but he does give his blessing to them.
Yeah.
Basically.
Into Sif now. It's done. You know, I think Odin helped and like nudged that too. So yeah. But your will is not your own when your dad is Odin.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's true. Good point.
All right, fellas, that's the issues we had to talk about for this episode. So if we had a buck to spend on comics in November 1969, if we had already bought the four issues that we talked about with the Hines brothers, Avengers 72, X-Men 64, Amazing Spider-Man 81, and Fantastic Four number 95, that would leave us with 40 cents left over. That is enough for two comics with a dime left over. Which ones will it be? Ooh, Rob, man. What are your calls?
This is hard. I would take Thor for sure because it's still Kirby and it's still glorious. Mm-hmm. And so like sight unseen, I'd just be like Thor. Yeah. I mean, that's why I also wanted to talk about Thor this month. But then it gets a little more complicated, but it's only down to two. It's Iron Man because of the giantness of that, or Cap because of the beautiful first five pages. And mm-hmm. I have to go with Cap. Like, that is my favorite Cap, the Cap that doubts the system, the Cap that questions his symbolism. So if I had any hint of that being in that Captain America issue, I would because I would have grabbed it off of the rack and started reading it until the clerk yelled at me. So I would have already known, because that was my life as a young lad. So Cap and Thor.
Very nice. Wow. Jamie, what would your picks be?
All right. I'm going to rule out Submariner because that issue, I think, is the closest of this batch to just kind of like not working.
Yeah. I mean, it's a great issue of Doctor Strange, which is canceled already. Yeah.
The thing is, like, if it was an issue of Doctor Strange, it would have been better than the average issue of Doctor Strange. But that just really underscores how bad that book was.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Thor didn't really do it for me, even though the art is like very stellar. It was just like a random kind of villain of the month kind of thing who like came and went all too quickly. I want to give an honorable mention to Silver Surfer. I feel like this, weirdly, even though it involved witches, was maybe the best issue we've had of that book in a while.
It still sucks, but yes.
Yeah, you still get a little bit of his sadness, but it's not like so melancholic that it's like a billion pages wasted on it. And like, he's still not like siding with humanity. And I don't know. I just thought it was like a step in the right direction. Maybe I'm always rooting for that Surfer book.
Uh-huh.
Daredevil was also really cool to look at. And I felt like would have qualified, except it lacks in the end. I think like
But it was Hollis all along.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, like if that bit hadn't been in there, I think maybe it would have been a contender. So yeah, I'm just going to go with Iron Man for the potential that her death could have, and Captain America for that beginning stuff. That was great.
Cool. I also have to definitely go with Iron Man. I just think, regardless of how intentional all of it was, I think the subtext and the implication that Tony Stark is maybe not a great guy who maybe doesn't know what he's doing. Mm-hmm. And like his poor decisions have dire consequences for the people in his life. I think that's really interesting.
Yeah, it is. You're totally right.
I like, love that Eddie Marsh survived it too. Like I thought he was going to die for sure.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. The fact that these people are the first generation of these heroes, and that they don't know what they're doing, and there isn't much precedent. Like, oh man, if they leaned into that or revisited it, it could be so cool.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
What else you got, Brian?
Yeah, well, the other one I've got, I am actually going to go with Thor. And I think I realize, like, as we get closer and closer to having no more Jack Kirby for a while, I am now looking at issues that Kirby works on, and it's like, if they do nothing to disqualify themselves, then I enjoy them.
Yeah.
And I really do think that with the recent editorial decision to try to do as many self-contained stories as possible, I think it's really it's helping sharpen his storytelling a little bit. Like things like the condensed, you know, punchy, like beginning, middle, end stories. I love the way he visually tells a story. I never get tired of that. I love like all the background detail and everything. And it had Bill Everett doing the inks instead of Vince Coletta. I really like Bill Everett as an artist generally. Mm-hmm. And it's such a weird story. Like, I mean, it's not
coming at all.
Yeah, it is pretty strange start to finish.
Yeah. It's not a Thor story. I don't know what it is, but it's like some kind of like 1950s, like, you know, man with two brains kind of thing. Like,
If you cut out the god business of Odin in the beginning, there's nothing like Thor particular about any of this.
No, not at all. So
I noticed we all did not pick Hulk, which is a huge Hulk issue, but I feel like, it wasn't Herb Trimpe. Like, who now I think he maybe did layouts, but none of the art looked like him. And so felt like a fill in, even though it was like Bruce Banner almost getting married, you know?
That's a really good point. Like, I was trying to figure out why that one just didn't land for me. And
I do like the way the leader looks with Sal Buscema's art. Like, yeah,
taller.
Yeah, taller head, more streamlined, but everything about it just didn't feel like it was done. It felt like it was dashed off, which is so weird.
I think I'm also getting a little leader fatigue. We've seen a lot of him lately, so, and we're going to see a lot more of him.
But so. I love Rhino. I don't know. It's just, he's such a doof.
He didn't get a chance to do a ton in this issue.
Yeah, but
why was he even there?
He was driving the oil truck with his popped collar.
Blue robot could have done that.
Yeah, that's true. The cross-eyed blue robot. That's what I call him.
The Homer bot.
Well, okay, sorry about the aside. I just wanted to mention that, you know, that thing about Hulk, because it's telling that none of us picked it at this point. Because it wasn't Hulk Fight Army. It was a meaningful Hulk story. But it was
Hulk... Hulk Crash Wedding.
Hulk Crash Wedding. That's great. You just, like, there was no chance that was going to go well. So it didn't feel like particularly suspenseful or like, oh my gosh, I wonder what's going to happen next.
Yeah. It feels like if they had taken that story in two halves, like if they had done the wedding up to the moment and not given you all the teasers, that it was definitely not going to go well. And just sudden, I don't know. I'm not usually a big vote for the sudden twist of the leader shows up with the Rhino and shoots a ray at the Hulk. But that would have been a bigger drama for this story anyway. But
I agree.
Well, that's our issues for this month. And that means that's the end of this episode. So thank you so much for listening. And for those of you who support us on Patreon at patreon.com/MarvelByTheMonth, thank you so much for doing that. If you are not a supporter, what you get out of that is for $4 a month, you get extended versions of our episodes that have special guests. You get bonus episodes. And if we hit our goal, we are recording this at the very end of September right now. If we manage to get 5 new Patreon subscribers by the end of this month, then the first episode that we record in October is going to have a very special surprise at the end of it for our Patreon subscribers. Rob, do you want to tell the people a little bit about that?
Yes. Imagine, if you will, a young Rick Jones in a coffee bar in New York City playing his very first song, which he did in a recent Captain Marvel issue. We did imagine it. And then I imagined it where I couldn't sleep and imagined it for days until it became real. And Rick Jones spoke to me through the green door. And I'm ready to make this song real. So, it's in my head. It's done. It's like, I've got some ideas of the chords. I know what's going to happen. So just give us a few bucks and, we're going to make Rick Jones come to life.
Yeah, there you go. So it's too late to be part of the 5 new Patreon subscribers in September. But the only way that you're going to get to hear that song, if we did hit our goal, is if you are a Patreon subscriber. So patreon.com/MarvelByTheMonth. Check it out. Also, leave a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts for us or wherever you listen to us. It helps people discover the podcast. If you would like to get some free stuff in the mail, send a screenshot of it to marvelbythemonth@gmail.com with your mailing address for some, a random grab bag of some Marvel by the Month merch. I have a review here by Son of the Wolf 1969, who titled their review, "I Listen While Drawing. Excelsior, I've been reading comics since 1977 and listening to podcasts since 2005, and I can say that this is one of my favorites. I'm pretty familiar with each of the issues discussed, so it's fun to imagine the panels described again. These hosts, Brian and Rob," does not mention Jamie, "have many of the same thoughts on Marvel issues that I've always had. They love them for how goofy they are, but they really love comics. Thank you for this lifesaver of a podcast. I listen to it all the time while I'm working, drawing cartoons for Disney." It really hits the spot. "Being an artist, I really enjoy the description of how Gene Colan draws or how Chick Stone inks. Great pod. I can't wait till they get to the 70s. Thank you very much, Son of the Wolf, 1969. Nice. That's awesome.
Yeah. Oh, man. So awesome. Thank you.
Yeah. Let's see. Last things. Instagram's our main social channel. You can find us there at Marvel by the Month. MarvelByTheMonth.com has links to our other social channels as well as our shop. Thank you so much for listening to this Omnibus episode. We will see you next week for next month.